When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you to a live episode of Real Talk with Zuby. This is a first time doing it in this format, so you guys are going to have to let me know what you think about this. This is going out live right now on YouTube, on Twitter, and on Facebook, so let me know what you think of this format. Now, today's guest is a police officer from New York in the U.S. of A., and this is, of course, Zeke Arkham, the cop with an attitude. Welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Thanks, brother. Thanks for having me on. It's definitely an honor.
Awesome, man. It's an honor to have you on, bro. So I've done a real brief intro there, but for people who are not familiar with who you are, tell them a little bit about you, man.
Like you said, I'm a cop in New York City. I have 15 years of experience. I've worked everything, you know, from patrol to undercover to specialty units, you know, gang, drugs. I've done it all. I've worked in tactical units. So, I've always been involved in different details, and I've had a great career so far. Definitely happy for the decisions I've made. And I'm at the last half of it. So, I'm looking forward to closing it out.
No doubt, man. Well, let's run it back a little bit, man. I mean, how did you get into the police force? What made you decide to go into that? What was, tell us a little bit about your life story and background behind that.
Well, I was actually a bouncer in New York before I became a cop. So I liked that, you know, being outside. I liked, you know, talking to people, being face to face with them. You know, I tried an office job. I hated it. I didn't want to sit at a desk all day or, you know, just sit and be bored looking at a wall. So, I actually put in for the police department and I put in for the fire department, and the police department called me back first.
Oh, okay. Wow. And, did you grow up in New York? Is that where you're originally from as well?
Yep. Born and raised. It's the only place I've ever lived. It's the only place I've ever, you know, really experienced. Mm-hmm. I wanted to live in other parts of the United States, but New York is pretty much all its own.
I hear that, man. And what was it like growing up in New York? I mean, especially over the past couple of decades, I know it's a city that's changed a lot, through the 80s, the 90s, the 1000s. How's it changed and what was your experience like?
It's funny because I grew up in South Jamaica, Queens.
Okay, yeah.
Which is a pretty rough neighborhood.
That's where 50 Cent's from, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I know that.
I actually knew his family growing up.
Really?
His family lived down the block from where my grandmother was.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then I lived in East New York, Brooklyn, where Notorious B.I.G. is from. So I've got all these connections to these rappers. But both neighborhoods have changed a lot, especially East New York, Brooklyn. You're seeing a lot of trendy hotels, sidewalk cafes. You know, if you had told me back in 1992 when I grew up there that there would be a sidewalk cafe in a trendy hotel where I grew up, I would have never believed you. But I went there about a month ago. I hadn't been there since the early 90s, and I went there about a month ago, and my partner that I was driving around with must have been very confused, because I was, you know, hey, look, there's a hotel here. look, there's a restaurant here. Look, there's cafe here, you know? So, you know, he could, you know, to him, he'd never been there before. So he didn't know why I was bugging out so bad. But yeah, it's definitely a change.
No doubt, man. I mean, what was it like at that time? I mean, you hear stories, of course, you hear of, you know, this part of this town being dangerous or this part being dangerous or whatever. But what was it like in reality, you know, your childhood, your teenage years, et cetera? What was it like growing up in that sort of environment?
Honestly, I didn't know I lived in a bad neighborhood. Mm. I played with my friends out in front of our building. I went to the store. You know, I walked around all times of the night.
Yep.
I didn't know I was in a bad neighborhood. I guess, you know, I don't know if my mom shielded me from a lot or I was just very, I was used to it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I lived in a bad neighborhood until I moved into another section of Queens. And then I started telling people, like, you know, this is where I'm from. They were like, oh, you know, to me, it was just growing up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you could always tell when someone bought a new gun because they would go to the top of my building and start just target practice on the roof.
Oh, wow.
So to me, it was, you know, it was just that happens at night. You know,
yeah.
I had no idea. You know, even the Chinese food stores here, you know, back in Brooklyn or in South Jamaica, there's like a thick plexiglass separating you from the worker. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that was out of the ordinary until I moved to Queens. And it was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, there's no plexiglass.
That's funny, man.
So I had no idea.
Oh, interesting, man. And so tell us about getting involved in the police force. So you said you applied to both the police and the fire department as well. So what was that process like? And once you got accepted, run us through the process there.
Well, I mean, everybody says it's easy to become a cop. I can tell you firsthand, it is not.
Okay.
There's a whole battery of psychological tests you have to take. There's a physical test you have to take. I mean, do they push a couple candidates through for diversity's sake? I'm guessing maybe, mm-hmm. but, it's not a process that just anyone can get into. My best friend growing up actually applied to the police department and he got disqualified and he's an Army veteran.
Okay. Disqualified on what basis?
He told him how much he drinks. You know, he developed a little bit of a drinking problem in the Army and, he told him exactly how much he drinks and they disqualified him.
Gotcha.
So it's not a simple, easy process. It's not a process where just anyone can get in. You know, do a few bad apples slip through the cracks? Yeah. You know, I'm not going to say that's not the case, but it's not a simple process.
Yeah.
And then once you're in the academy, they test you even more, you know, just physically, mentally. You know, they prepare you for the job. Mm-hmm. And then your first year on the job is extremely eye-opening. So, I mean, you're constantly getting tested. You're constantly getting pushed to the next level. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to just be stagnant my whole career. I didn't want to just work in one place. And, you know, and for guys that are doing that, there's nothing wrong with that. But me personally, I just wanted to always achieve more.
Gotcha.
I wanted to achieve as much as I possibly could. So, you know, when Undercover opened up, I went into it. Mm-hmm. When, you know, different units came along, Vice, Gang, I went into it. So, like I said, you know, I've enjoyed my career. I've done a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife is always saying that, you know, I'm not the same person that she met when we first started dating.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's true. You know, it does change your perspective. The more you do, the more your perspective changes. The more you see, the more your perspective changes. So, you know, it's not like you just, you know, all of a sudden became this person that, you know, with the same viewpoints that you were, that you didn't have when you first started. You're definitely changed by life experience. Mm-hmm.
What are some of those changes, man? Talk us through that. So what was something that, or what were some of the things that you felt or you believed when you went into it that you've shifted on over time? How did that happen?
Wow. There's a lot. You know, I had a lieutenant who sort of took me under his wing when I first joined the job. And he said to me, too, he was a black lieutenant. And he said, no matter what your viewpoints are now, they're going to change. He goes, the more you get involved in the job, the more you do, the more your viewpoints are going to change. You know, just between immigration, illegal immigration, things like that, between just different stances on social justice. You know, when you work hard to put someone behind bars and they're let go almost immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, viewpoints on gun control, things like that. Mm-hmm. They all change. You know, just to give you an example, just for gun control. Before I took the job, I didn't think anyone should have a gun. You know, what do you need a gun for?
Yeah.
And now I'm a huge proponent of the Second Amendment. You know, mm-hmm. So.
What was it specifically that shifted your view on that?
I mean, just seeing how people were attacked in their homes and had nothing to defend themselves with. You know, pushing robberies were a big thing for a while. Mm-hmm. And people always said, you know, if I had a gun, I would have been able to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And I start to see more and more like, wow, you know, yeah, you know, the Second Amendment is there for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, it's for protection, most of all. You know, my job allows you to have an on-duty gun and an off-duty gun. Mm-hmm. And a lot of cops buy a couple more guns. And I've turned into one of them. You know.
Yeah, no, it's something that's really interesting. You know, I'm not American, but I am very pro Second Amendment. But obviously, being someone who is from and lives in the UK, it's a really interesting conversation to have with people from different perspectives. You know, if you talk to people here in the UK or generally in Europe, it tends to be more like the former opinion that you have or had. Whereas if, you know, you talk to more, certainly if you talk to more, you know, especially conservative leaning Americans or some, not most, but some conservative Brits or Europeans, they tend to be sort of more pro Second Amendment. So it's really interesting to see the sort of arguments on both sides and even what words mean to people. So when someone says gun control, you know, what do they mean by that? I mean, I'm here in the UK, like the cops don't even have guns here for the most part, right? You know, only the specialist units do, let alone the citizens. So in the UK, it's a very foreign concept to a lot of people, the idea of citizens owning guns. But then I know in a lot of parts and to a lot of people in the USA, the notion of citizens not being able to own guns, or police especially not having guns, it just strikes them as really bizarre. So I'm really fascinated about just the different perspectives on issues like that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, you go from not, you know, believing that no one should have a gun, or, you know, the gun ownership should be very limited, to now I'm just sort of like, you know, get whatever you can get your hands on.
Okay.
You know, legally. But then again, I've always made the argument. I've made a couple gun arrests. Mm-hmm. I have never arrested a legal firearm owner for shooting in the street.
Yeah.
You know, everybody I've ever arrested for shootings or having a gun doesn't have a permit.
Yeah.
You know, so if these quote unquote bad guys have guns and they're getting access to everything they can get their hands on, you know, if I'm a legal, law-abiding citizen, why can't I have that same firepower?
Yeah.
You know, just to protect my family, to protect my home, to protect myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
no, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Finish your thought.
No, there was an officer involved shooting a couple weeks ago, where an officer was driving home, and someone attempted to carjack him.
Oh wow.
And he the only reason he was able to stop it was because he had a firearm on him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm with law-abiding citizens on this. You know, to me, it's not like really a good guy, bad guy kind of thing.
I get
you. If you're obeying the law and you have that for your protection, I don't understand why there's such a pushback against it. But, you know, like I said, that's me personally, just from my experiences in law enforcement.
Yeah, sure thing. No, I understand that. That's a really interesting perspective, especially to hear that from, you know, a law enforcement officer. When it comes to something like the Second Amendment, I mean, when people talk about the Second Amendment, when people talk about gun control, do you think that where do you think those lines should be drawn? Do you think that any additional gun control measures are needed? Do you think that there's enough, but the laws need to be enforced better? Do you think perhaps there's already too many restrictions? I know people who think that as well. What are your sort of thoughts on that? Because there's a range of opinions on that as well. You know, there's the people who full on think, you know, you should be able to own, you know, shall not be infringed. I should be able to own a tank, rocket launcher, sniper rifle, you know, machine gun, whatever I want. And then you have the people who are more like, you know, maybe it should be limited to these guns or this magazine capacity, or there should be this check or that check. Where do you stand on that?
Honestly, listen, if you have the money to go out and buy a tank, I'm all for it. give me a ride, you know? Hey, listen, you
know? Fair enough.
You know, hey, listen, I want to drive it, you know? So, it's like I said, you know, I think the current laws on the books are good enough.
Yeah.
As far as psychological background checks, as far as you know, making sure you're not a felon, mm-hmm. I'm all for that. That's great. Rah, rah, good. That's it, you know, enforce the current laws.
Yeah.
You know, most legal gun owners out there, they just want to do the right thing. They're not looking to bother anybody. They carry just for their protection or to stop a threat. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not, you know, shooting out in the streets or firing shots in the air. You know, they just want to be left alone for the most part to be private citizens. I'm all for that. You know, I've always gone on record to say, you know, let's say, God forbid, if anything does come down, they want me to go house to house confiscating firearms, I got to run home and get my stash, you know, I got to check my stash.
Yeah, so, that's interesting.
I'm definitely on board with the Second Amendment.
I hear that, man, 100%. So with that said and that established, I mean, this is a big conversation. I mean, what do you think can be done to reduce firearm violence and firearm deaths? You know, whether you're talking about mass shootings, which obviously get a lot of publicity, understandably, you know, mass shootings, school shootings, or, you know, just gang violence in general, which is going to be, you know, account for far more homicides than either of the former two. What do you think are some of the potential solutions for that?
Well, I'm all for personal accountability. I want to see the parents get more involved.
Yeah.
You know, I've done youth counseling when I was in gang. I was one of the cops that, you know, I would pull you aside, and, you know, if you were a gang member, mm-hmm. and just try to talk to you, you know, get in your head a little bit, you know, see mm-hmm. why you embrace this lifestyle. And the common theme that I got from those side conversations were just these kids really have no father figure in their lives. And then here comes a gang with older guys that come along as father figures and directly point them in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. You know, the parents have to get more involved. You know, make sure your kid's going to school. Make sure your kid has an education. Make sure your kid, you know, isn't playing with the wrong kids or isn't hanging out with the wrong people. You know, there's got to be more of a family atmosphere involved. Yeah. You can set up all kinds of laws. You can set up all kinds of programs. You can set up, you know, after school basketball. You can set up midnight basketball, anything you want. But the parents have to get more involved. Mm-hmm. I've always said that the parents have to get more involved. Yeah. The reason I'm the man who I am today is because my mom made sure she knew who my friends were. She made sure my homework was done. Mm-hmm. She was at every parents teachers conference, even though I hated it at the time. I see, you know, how it is now. You know, the parents have to get more involved.
Yeah.
Aside from that, you know, you should be able to, I've always felt you should be able to have more control over your child's education. If your child isn't getting the proper education at one school, mm-hmm. why shouldn't you be allowed to send them to another? Either that or hold that school responsible. If enough parents are saying, you know, my kid's not getting a great education at this school, talk to the principal, talk to the teachers. What are you doing? What are you not doing? It's got to start basically like that. It can't just be, you know, the state comes in and fixes the problem, or the government comes in and fixes the problem. Mm-hmm. That's never worked.
Yeah.
It's got to start with the parents.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. I think I think everything starts with family. You know, I think the biggest problem in a lot of communities, especially, is, you know, broken families and fatherless households, right? That's such a huge issue. And it's kind of this elephant in the room, which, you know, some people do talk about, but for even those of us who advocate for it and talk about it, I myself, you know, also wonder, okay, what are the sort of very tangible and practical steps that can be taken to shift that, you know, because it probably won't happen in a generation. It might take a generation or two. I'm like yourself. I'm huge on personal responsibility, but I often wonder, okay, for, you know, people in certain circumstances, how can those values be instilled, you know, because they used to be there. That's the thing. It's like, that's one thing where I think society's taken a big step backwards, right? We've moved forward in technology. We've moved forward in medicine and all these other things, even in terms of social attitudes. But when it comes to marriage and relationships and raising children and, you know, fathers sticking around and morality around, you know, sex and all that stuff, which has real downstream repercussions, as we both know, that's just backslid so hard. You know, it's just gone so far backwards to the point where I often look at the situation. I'm like, man, how can this be how can this be reversed? Like, how can you encourage and teach and incentivize people, you know, men and women, you know, fathers and mothers, to really do the right thing? And, you know, for fathers not to knock up a whole bunch of women and, you know, disappear and not be in their children's lives, and, you know, women not to go out and get pregnant by a bunch of different dudes, all that kind of uncomfortable stuff. That's where it stems from, if you really think about it. And I think by the time we're trying to deal with some of these issues, you're already, like, you know, you're two decades too late, right? Like, all that stuff has already happened, and now you're trying to deal with the dysfunctional symptoms of it. And you get the same thing in many countries. I mean, here in the UK, it tends to be knives rather than guns, but, you know, you still get the same violence in certain cities and things like that. And it seems like when they're trying to deal with it, they're always trying to deal with a symptom, but they're not addressing or really even attempting to address any of the root causes. So do you have any ideas around that?
Well, one thing I've learned, you know, I was able to move my family. We live in Long Island now. We're a little bit more, you know, it's a different atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I'm noticing more just in this neighborhood as opposed to where I grew up is you're always setting your children up for success. Mm. You know, everything is centered towards your children doing better than you. Even my mom, when she raised me, she always said, you know, I want you to do better than this. Mm-hmm. You know, I did what I could with what I had, but I want you to do better. She sacrificed so that my brothers and I could do better. And we, mm-hmm. and, you know, we all did. Even in this neighborhood here, you know, the schools, they make sure the schools are on point. They make sure playgrounds are on point. They make sure, you know, summer classes and summer learning is on point. Everything is done to set your kids up to have a better education than you had so that they can achieve more. Mm-hmm. You know, when I grew up in some of the projects where I, you know, in South Jamaica or in Brooklyn, you know, you had parents there that actually, like, would point to the projects and go, if this is good enough for me, it's good enough for my children.
Oh, wow.
And to me, that was like a crazy mindset, you know? You know, it's like, but wait, there's garbage on the ground and there's spray paint and graffiti. You know, there's gangs hanging up on the roof. Like, yeah. You're okay with your children staying here? And they really had no problem with it. Yeah, if this is good enough for me, this is good enough for them. Mm. You know, nothing is done to elevate the next generation. And I think more of it has to be done. You know, you don't have to sentence your children or sentence future generations to how you grew up. You can make sure they do better. Encourage them to pursue educational, activities. You know, encourage them to read. Encourage them to do things to better themselves. You know, you ask the question, why do legal immigrants come here, either from China or from India or even from other places like, you know, Africa, Jamaica, places like that, and they do so much better here than homegrown Black folk here. And it's because they see this place as a land of opportunity. They're going to make sure that their children and the next generations after that do as well as they can in order to elevate their bloodline, so to speak. And that's just not going on in certain neighborhoods, you know, especially where I grew up. I have friends that still live there. Mm-hmm. I have friends that still, you know, they're in the same apartments. They're doing the same things, hang out in the same corners. And they look at me, who's a homeowner, who's mm-hmm. going to, you know, hopefully retire in 5 years. And they're like, oh, well, you're an anomaly. You know, you're the X factor. Yeah. We can't all do what you've done.
Yeah.
And my answer to them is I didn't do anything special. You know, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like I've got some sort of genius level intellect. You know, I like to think I do, but it's not like, you know, I did something that no one else could achieve. You know, I had the same exact opportunities you did. I did the mm-hmm. same things you did. But they make excuses. Oh, well, you know, I didn't have this in my life. I didn't have that in my life, which are just minor things, you know. You could easily do what I do, but you didn't. So I think more of that has to be done. Just elevate the next generation.
I hear that totally, man. What do you think is the biggest issue facing, let's call it, the Black American community in the U.S.? I don't really like that term because I think that it's too broad, right? You can't have 13 million. What do I mean? No, like 40 million. It's like 40 million Black Americans, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think like 40 million people can really be considered a community like that. But what do you think are the biggest issues facing that? Because, you know, you ask this question to different people, especially depending on where they sit sociopolitically, you tend to get very different answers. What do you think is the biggest hurdle in that sense?
Well, I'll tell you a quick story. When I was about 17 or 18, I was feeling sorry for myself, and I was complaining to my mother. You know, my father was barely around or wasn't there. I didn't have this growing up. I didn't have that growing up. I didn't live in this neighborhood. I didn't live in that neighborhood. And my mother looked at me and she said, "You know what? You're absolutely right. Now get over it." You know, that's that tough love, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, and my feelings were hurt for about a good week. Mm-hmm. You know, I avoided my mom for a week, but then I sat and I thought about it and I went, you know what? She's right.
Yeah.
Get over it.
Yeah.
You know, that victim mentality, I think, keeps a lot of people shackled. Mm. You know, just failing to get out of your own way.
Yeah.
You know, blaming everything else for your issues, you know, blaming some mystery white man somewhere, blaming racism, blaming, you know, other things. You know, I told you, I used to speak to my great granddad a lot.
Okay.
And he grew up in 1920s North Carolina.
Okay.
So he experienced bona fide racism. He experienced racism that, you know, me hearing those stories, I feel like I can't even complain, you know.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, he used to tell me about how, you know, if he had a friend that he hadn't seen in 2 days, he just assumed that friend was dead.
Wow.
You know, and sure enough, they'd be walking down the street going to school and they'd see their friend dead, you know, being lynched or being
serious
shot.
What?
Yeah.
Jeez.
That's just how prevalent it was back in 1920s North Carolina.
Wow.
That's, you know,
insane.
And everyone knew who did it too, you know, really? But nothing could be done about it. That they just face that kind of racism and that kind of hate. Mm. And right before he passed away, he just looked at me and he said, "You know what?" He goes, "I would have gone through all of this again, everything I went through, you know, in my childhood, my youth, to see my children and my grandchildren and my great grandchildren succeed the way you guys have." And that just meant so much to me at the time.
Yeah,
you know, I'm standing on his shoulders. So, you know, just take away that victim mentality. Mm. You know, if my great granddad never saw himself as a victim and worked to make sure that the future generations could do better, so can I, who has it so much more easier than he did.
Yeah, man, that's crazy. It is. You know, that is something that does frustrate me with a lot of the stuff that's going on, you know, right now in 2020, when people talk about certain issues, when people, you know, are very quick to throw around the terms racism, institutional racism, structural racism, systemic racism, white supremacy, all these things where it's like, look, you know, I don't think there are many people in the world who deny that racism exists to some degree, and that there are some racist people in society, and that there are some overhangs of historic racism that affect people, you know, in the modern world, especially if you're looking at Black Americans, for example. But when you have that sort of comparison and reference point, like what you were just saying about your great grandfather, then that's when I'm just like, geez, like we always want things to be getting better, but people are acting like it's getting worse in that regard. I know things are not perfect and things will never be perfect because human beings aren't, but compared to not that, you know, you were saying 1920, that's not that long ago. That's 100 years. 100 years is one person.
Yeah.
That's one lifetime, you know, one and a half lifetimes. And the progress that's been made in that time is just insane. And I feel like a lot of the stuff that's going on now, a lot of this whole like anti-racism movement, the BLM stuff, I feel like it's pouring gasoline on the embers. Racism is trying really hard to die out, and people keep resuscitating it. Like, people are just there, you know, no, like, come back, you know? And they're just creating unnecessary tension and animosity and making people see race again a lot, you know, like, go back to this, you know, black this, white that, black this, white. And I'm just like, guys, like, you know, like, the longer, the more you do that, it's like the wound is trying to heal and people just keep picking at it. I mean, I'm sure you must have some interesting thoughts on the whole BLM movement and the I don't know where to begin with that one, but it must not have been an easy year to be a police officer, let alone a black police officer in America. So, man, I don't know what the question is, but tell me your feelings on that.
You know what? I've worked more BLM rallies than I care to have ever experienced in my life. And what's interesting is, they come straight for me.
Yeah.
You know, me and all the other black officers. They'll push the white officers aside. Excuse me. You. You know. Yeah. I remember there was one rally where this woman, a black woman, for two straight hours, just went into me. Like, I mean, just for two straight hours. I wanted to say to her, yo, lady, can I get a break? Like,
wow.
Can you take a break? You know, can we pause? You know, I mean, just for two straight hours. I mean, and you know, just like, you know, it's like you said, like, they're not helping the situation at all. You can't point to anything that's been done positively that's because of BLM. You know, from Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, all the way to BLM marching in the streets, to people painting BLM, you know, Black Lives Matter, on the street. Mm-hmm. Nothing positive has come out of this. You can't say, you know, this law has been drafted directly because of Black Lives Matter, or, you know, because Colin Kaepernick took a knee. Mm-hmm. Now these conversations have been had and this progress has been made. You know, they fashion themselves a modern era civil rights activists, and that's just not the case. Mm-hmm. They haven't done half the stuff, a quarter of the stuff, a tenth of the stuff that was actually done during the civil rights era, when there was actual bona fide racism and segregation going on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you said, you know, you're pouring gas on smoldering embers. Those embers could go out on their own.
Yeah.
But you're pouring gas on them.
Yeah.
They're making things worse.
What was this woman saying to you? I'm curious.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I don't know what I'd chastise someone for two straight hours. So I'm curious.
Oh, wow. I got called a coon. Probably out of that 2 hours, probably half of that was probably me getting called a coon. Mm-hmm. And Uncle Tom. Mm-hmm. Me being called an oppressor, an overseer.
Oh, wow.
A house Negro. I mean, I think she had like just a checklist of every name she could call me. And she just went down that checklist and then went right back up it again. Mm-hmm. You know, just for 2 hours. Matter of fact, it probably would have been longer, but I had to, you know, go take action somewhere. I had to walk away from her.
Yeah.
But she was determined.
And this is simply for you being black and being a police officer.
This is just me being black and a police officer. No other reason. Yeah. I'd never seen this woman before in my life. You know, she had no idea who I was. Yeah, just for being black and a police officer. Matter of fact, my partner at the time was another black cop. Mm-hmm. And he stood there with me and watched me take it. And we both got it.
Did she have any what did she want from you? Did she want you to just, you know, hand in your resignation? Did she have any requests that were like, you know, this is a particular grievance which I would like addressed? Or
no, she just I don't even think me handing in my resignation would have done anything. she picked me.
Yeah.
And this other officer, and she just went in. I mean, it was just for 2 hours, like, you know.
That's crazy. Is this I'm just curious, is this an older woman, younger woman?
She was an older woman.
Older, yeah. Okay.
I think if you talk to other black cops, they've all had the same exact experience working these rallies and details. Mm. You know, they'll come straight for you.
Yeah, I've seen some videos. I've seen some videos of it. It's strange, because I also think, like, whether or not I agree with somebody's movement or activism, I think they need to be clear on what they want, right?
Exactly.
So this is the thing, right? If you look back at civil rights era, like true social justice, you know, movements, there were particular things that they wanted addressed, and they had, you know, okay, this is a potential solution for this. This is a solution for this. This is a clear request, right? We want the right to vote. We want to end segregation. We want to be allowed to go to these schools and these public facilities, et cetera, right? We just want to be integrated into society as Americans as we are, right? That's totally, I get it, right? But
right.
When it's just this sort of random anger going around and people like just, I don't know, shouting or, you know, looting, committing criminal activity, like whatever. And it's just, you know, what is this in the name of, you know? Everyone around the world was upset and outraged about the George Floyd incident. But the next thing you know, it looks like American cities are on fire. Statues are being toppled in the UK, right? Like things are going on in Australia. And I'm just like, wait, what is going on here, right? This is like a collective insanity, which, you know, some of the anger is, you know, potentially righteous anger, but it's all just spilled out into this, I call it emotional incontinence. It's just like, it's just all over the place. And when that happens, it makes things worse. It doesn't make anything better, because there's no, even if you do listen, it's like, okay, well, what's the proposed solution? You know, what are your ideas? And it has to make sense, not just defund the police or dismantle the police. Like that's not a viable solution here. But you know, and then when they have, you know, the whole ACAB thing, right? All cops are bad.
Yeah.
I mean, that must've been annoying, surely.
Oh no! I mean, I've heard all the chants. I've heard all of the little slogans and everything else. I mean, it's just, you know, you're just like, okay, well, you know, like, I mean, you mentioned George Floyd,
yeah.
And I think we were all on board with what we saw, that it was wrong. You know, even cops were saying it. You know, I said it.
Yeah.
You know, what I saw there was wrong.
Yeah.
I saw the body cam footage before, so it helps to explain exactly what was going on in the minds of the officers. I don't like to Monday morning quarterback cops, just because, you know, you have the clarity there. You can see it from different eyes. So I can't say whether or not I would have reacted that way.
Mm-hmm.
Just me personally, I probably wouldn't have. I probably would have stood him up, just because, you know, just I'm very conscious of of what everything looks like to other people.
Yes.
Or, you know, that's one of the things, you know, modern policing, you keep in mind. You're very conscious of what it looks like and what things look like from cameras and edited YouTube videos, and, you know, they make you look very bad.
Mm.
So I don't know if I would have handled it the same way that this gentleman did, this officer did. But we were all on board. You know, after mm-hmm. George Floyd, we all felt sympathy for George Floyd. We also felt sympathy for that situation. We were on board.
Yeah.
And then came the looting and the rioting, you know, the quote unquote, mostly peaceful looting and rioting. Mm-hmm. You know, I was out there. I was out there when they tried to take over some of the precincts. I was out there when they were throwing Molotov cocktails into the vans.
Yeah.
You know, I was there. I there's no way I can support any of that at all. And then just, you know, the next day you hear elected officials going, you know, the police had a very aggressive, overly aggressive response to it. And you're like, wait, you know, no, we didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that was something I heavily disagreed with.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, like I said, it's not something I don't think I can ever really get on board with, Black Lives
yeah.
Matter, especially when, if you look at the numbers of officer-involved shootings as compared to Black-on-Black crime, which no one wants to talk about, you know, are there bad police shootings? Yes, I'm not going to say that every police shooting is 100% on board.
Yeah.
Are there bad police shootings? Yes. But they're so minuscule and they're so small that they're almost not even a factor as compared to Black-on-Black shootings. I think, for example, in Chicago this past weekend, there were 50 shootings.
It's wild.
You know, and it just increases every week. Like, it yeah. never takes a break. It's just there's always at least 40 to 50 shootings in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
In Baltimore, there are always 40 to 50 shootings. in St. Louis, in Los Angeles, in certain parts of Brooklyn, there's always shootings going on. Why aren't we addressing that? Why aren't we putting a spotlight on that? Why aren't, you know, these neighborhood watch committees that want to go after cops, why aren't you going after the drug dealers, the gangbangers? Why aren't you looking at them and saying, hey, listen, they're directly contributing to the poison in this neighborhood. Yeah. Let's go after them. There are way more of us than there are of them. Let's go after them. Let's work with the police. But that's why I said, you know, the whole self-accountability thing, the whole victim mentality, that's what's holding a lot of Black Americans back, in my opinion. You know, it's, things are never going to get better until problems are addressed. You know, if, you know, we both work out a lot. If I have a torn tricep, you know, I can't bench press my way out of that. You know, I can't push up my way out of that. You know, you have to address that torn tricep before things get better. Same thing with Black Americans. You have to address the problems that are directly in your face before things get better.
No, I hear that totally, man. I hear that totally. I mean, a question I have for you is, especially as someone who's been in the force for a long time, is how do you stay positive, right? How do you not reach a stage where, you know, I think all of us get this feeling sometimes, right? Where, you know, we all have this sort of love-hate relationship with humanity itself. Right. So I love human beings. I love people. I'm a huge people person. Everything I do is about the people. But there are certain things you see or certain things you experience or certain things you hear, which just make you like, man, people suck. Like people are terrible. And as a police officer, like you deal with the dregs of society. Right. You deal with bad people. You deal with a lot of hostility. You deal with violence. You're dealing with gangs, drug dealers, all this kind of stuff. How do you maintain your sanity and peace and positivity to, you know, just kind of keep going day after day, month after month, year after year, especially in the face of a year like this one, where there is this spotlight, you know, there is this anti-police spotlight, and you may feel like you're not getting the, you know, appreciation that you should be getting for doing what is a very difficult job. Like, I don't want to be a police officer. I'm going to keep it 100 with you, right? Like, I'm like, no, I love what I do, right? You know, I get some criticism, but, you know, like, it's generally a lot more love, you know? So how do you handle that personally?
I handle the same way a lot of other cops are doing it. You know, you get up every day and you put your vest on, you put your gun belt on, you put your boots on, and you go out. You know, there are way more of those kind of cops than the, you know, quote unquote bad cops you see out there. You know, you don't take it out on someone that had nothing to do with how you feel. You know, I you know, when I worked on patrol, I made it a point to go to the local bodega and buy water or buy, you know, snacks or whatever, just so that they could see me every day. You know, I spend time doing youth mentoring and talking to kids, trying to get, you know, trying to at least be like almost like a big brother to them, to show them that there's another way. You know, I'm not trying to influence how they think. I'm not trying to influence any sort of political decisions they make. But I do ask them questions. You know, why do you feel this way? Explain why you don't like this person. You know, you can't start hating humanity and do this job at the same time. I know it's difficult, but you can't have that mentality. Because it sours you and it does turn you into one of those quote unquote bad cops where now all of a sudden you want to take out all your anger and frustration on someone that doesn't deserve it or does, I see videos, you know, a lot of cops snapping and swinging on people or punching people or, you know, cursing at people or yelling at them, and it's like, you can't have that mentality. There are people that were just born to be cops and born to take the blows and take the abuse, and they can start every day with a fresh outlook. And then there are those that probably shouldn't have the job. And I love my brothers in blue. I love my sisters in blue, but some of them shouldn't have the job. We're not discussing them. We're discussing the ones that should have the job.
Gotcha.
And, you know, you just every day you've got to just start with a fresh, positive outlook and say, I might run into somebody where I'm going to change their life. I'm going to influence how they think. I'm going to influence how they see cops. One of my pet peeves is when parents point to me, you know, if I'm in uniform and they go, hey, you see him? I'm going to tell the cop if you do something bad, you know?
Oh, okay.
That's like my pet peeve. You know, you're influencing a negative view of cops towards your child. Mm. So, you know, I used to make it a point, like, if I heard a parent say that, I would go up to the kid and shake their hand and you know, try to, you know, soothe their feelings a little bit.
Sure.
But, you know, you can't have that sort of mindset. And you have to just try to stay as positive as you can. You know, if you need a day to just sort of decompress, take mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
If you need, you know, to go away with your family or just go home and just hug your children a little harder, a little tighter, go ahead and do so. You know, my daughter gets unlimited hugs from me. So, you know, sometimes I need it more than she does. Yeah. So that's how I cope.
I understand, man. I hear that totally. What's the biggest misconception that people have about cops or about policing?
The whole good cop, bad cop thing.
Okay.
You know, I've already said, like, you know, I don't know what you think goes on in police locker rooms, but it's not like, you know, us good cops are huddled in the corner going, oh, no. And the bad cops are, you know, twirling their mustaches going, oh, you know, I'm going to go rob a liquor store today and no one's going to say anything. You know, and we're like, oh, no, you know, no. You know, I usually say, you know, when we hear about a quote unquote bad cop, we're hearing about it at the same time as everybody else is. You know, oh, wow. Hey, did you hear what happened to Johnson? Yeah, I had no idea he was doing that. Mm. And then I also ask, who do you think are out there arresting these bad cops? You know, the bad cop fairy? No, it's, you know, usually it starts with a tip from one of us, and we call internal affairs, and internal affairs goes and does what they have to do. You know, I had a good friend that I used to work with, and he turned out to be a bad cop, you know, a bona fide bad cop. And when they asked me about it, I said I had no idea he was doing that. You know, I would call him every now and again, we'd work out together, but I had no idea he was a bad cop. You know, he kept that from me.
Yeah.
I guess because he knew I was one of the good cops. I don't know what he thought, but he kept it from me. I had no idea. The notion that good cops aren't policing the bad cops is very false. There's no one that hates a bad cop more than a good cop, because they make all of our jobs harder. You know, we have to hear about, oh, well, what about this guy? Oh, what about that guy? You know, look at what that guy did. You know, I told you all cops are bad, you know, and then you find yourself defending the job. Or, you know, I've come to the point where I go, I cannot intelligently speak for what another cop does. I can speak for myself. I can speak over for a broad overview, but I can't explain what he did. You know, I don't want to.
Yeah.
The whole good cop, bad cop thing. There's just, like I said, you know, there's so many. Hollywood has sort of, I guess, glamorized the bad cop. You know, you don't see too many movies about, you know, a cop showing up, going to work, handling jobs, and then going home. You know,
that's not a movie, man. That's too boring.
No, that's too boring. Yeah. Nobody wants to sit through an hour and a half of that.
Yeah.
You know, but they want to glamorize the bad cop that, you know, goes out there and he's, you know, taking drugs and he gets to shootouts and, you know, and that's just not the case. That's just not the case. It's gotten to the point I can't even really watch cop movies anymore because I get frustrated. Mm. So, you know, that's definitely not the case.
Over this year, there's been a lot of talk of, you know, reforming the police or changing certain policies and things like that. In your perspective, speaking firsthand as an officer, what are the changes that you think should be made, that you think would be positive steps, whether that's to enhance the public perception of the police or perhaps to root out some of these so-called bad cops, bad apples, perhaps even at an earlier stage so that you don't get people who are even in the force to begin with, who, like you were saying before, really shouldn't be there. Are there any particular policies that you think would be effective?
I mean, the only thing I can think of that I personally would change. First of all, I would change the physical fitness standards. I would make it so that at least once a year you have to pass a physical fitness test. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of departments are already doing that. I'd like to see some of the big city departments start doing that. Just because I think that, just in my experience, I could be wrong, the more you care about your physical fitness and the more you care about your physical appearance, mm-hmm. Whether it's in uniform, outside of uniform, keeping physically fit, the more you're together just as a police officer or a law enforcement official. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying all of the big overweight cops are bad, mm-hmm. but you know, the more you take care of yourself, the more you care about your own health, mm-hmm. the more you care about just your society in general in your mind. That's the thing I would do personally. Maybe it's because I'm a fitness buff, maybe it's, mm-hmm. you know, because I'm a muscle head, but you know, that's one thing I would change.
Okay.
Again, you know, it's got to start with the community. Mm-hmm. You know, you can put all kinds of restrictions and sanctions on the cops you want. You can defund the police. You can dismantle the police, like what's happening in Minnesota right now, mm-hmm. Minneapolis. Excuse me. You can put all of these things into place. Criminals are still going to be criminals.
Yep.
They're still going to go out there and rob people and kill people and steal and destroy and sell drugs and do everything they can. It's got to stop the community. Yeah. I mean, putting restrictions on cops is the easy answer. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to make cops do this now. They're going to have to fill this paperwork out now. They're going to have to, you know, go to this training or go to that training now to make them more sensitive or make them more inclusive or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can do all that you want. It's got to stop the community. The community has to stand up and say, you know, we're tired of the shootings. We're tired of the gunshots. Mm-hmm. That's also my other beef with Black Lives Matter. You know, they haven't done a single rally to memorialize or try to find justice for children that have been shot.
Yeah,
or just random gang violence. You know, mm-hmm. their answer is always, oh, well, there's, you know, they did it. They rallied. You know, these mothers over here rallied. These people mm-hmm. over here rallied. Okay, but your name is Black Lives Matter. You have the attention of the media. You have the attention of the politician. Why aren't you out there bringing attention to this? Why aren't you out there rallying to make sure that this young child's killer is found?
Yes.
You know, it's got to stop the communities. You know, you can only do so much with cops. You have to do more with communities.
Yeah, man. No, I hear that totally, man. That's a criticism and a point I've been making. I was going to say all year. It's all, you know, the last 5-6 years I've been making that same point, because it's like, you know, it's focusing on 0.1% of the issue whilst ignoring 99.9%. And I agree. If you are, you know, I'm a Black man, you're a Black man. If you are going to call your movement or organizations Black Lives Matter, and you are ignoring over 99% of the things that kill Black people, then I'm sorry. Like, I don't take you serious, let alone the fact that you're then pushing all this other, you know, Marxist stuff or LGBT stuff or whatever, which has nothing to do with the name that's on the tin, right? If you are actually about Black Lives Matter, then let it be that. Let it not just be, you know, Black Lives Matter if they happen to be killed by a police officer in dubious circumstances and it's caught on camera, right? That's a really long acronym, but that's kind of what it is, you know? If it were actually Black Lives Matter, yes, we can. Like, everyone is on board with that. People are on board with that. But when it's like, oh no, we don't want to talk about that stuff, or no, we're not talking about that one. Oh no, that's like, that doesn't count. Those kids shot in Baltimore, Chicago. No, we can't talk about that. I'm just like, come on, man, this is so disingenuous to me. You know, it's a nice thing to throw in your bio and virtue signal and post your little hashtags and whatever and feel like you're some sort of revolutionary. But like you said, you know, ultimately it's like, what is getting done? What are the tangible positive results? I can see tangible negative results, but I'm not seeing the positive ones. I mean, I'm here in the UK. Maybe there's some stuff, you know, maybe I'll get someone from BLM on the podcast so I can see what positives have actually come out of it. But from what I see, it looks like race relations in America have gotten worse this year. It looks like things have been getting better. And I think this year it's taken a step back. And I don't think that's because of Trump or white supremacy or whatever. I think it's because of, you know, so-called anti-racism. I think it's because of some of this BLM stuff and the rioting, the looting, what people are seeing, all this critical race theory that's going into all these institutions and schools and organizations, all that stuff. I'm like, this is not helping. Like, this is not helping. This is all a step backwards to me.
Well, yeah, I've always said that Black Lives Matter should call themselves some Black Lives Matter. Mm. You know, put some in parentheses, you know, Black Lives Matter. Because, you know, hey, listen, if I get shot and it's not by a white cop, they couldn't care less. No. You know, it's almost like, you know, you're not being true to your name.
No.
And as far as 2020, yeah, you know, I think racism, if left alone, will die.
Yes.
You know, I don't think anybody really is just, I mean, do Black Lives Matter? Yes, of course. You know, who's going to say they don't? You know, yeah. who's going to sit there and go, I don't believe Black Lives Matter? Of course they do. That, but that's also why I say all lives matter. Mm-hmm. Because I'm, you know, if a cop does a bad shoot against a black man, I'm just as upset about that as I am if a black person kills another black person. I'm just as upset as if a black child or any child gets killed. I'm just as upset if a black child is aborted. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm upset over all of it. That's why I say all lives matter. You know, and it's not just black lives; it's white lives. It's Hispanic lives. It's to me, it's all lives. You know, that's why I became a police officer, because I want to stand up for all lives.
I hear you.
As far as this black injustice, I used to say that Black Lives Matter. You know, can you tell me exactly where this systemic racism is happening, and who's in charge of it? Can you let me know exactly where it's happening instead of just saying systemic racism as a broad umbrella term? Mm-hmm. And no one's been able to answer me with that.
Yeah.
You know, can you point out to me specifically where this systemic racism is going on in 2020? Mm-hmm. And then I usually get the, oh, well, slavery, you know, oh, no, we're not talking about slavery. I'm not a slave. You weren't a slave. You know, we don't know anybody that was a slave. We don't know anyone that knows anyone that was a slave. You know, I'm talking about today in 2020.
Yeah.
Well, back in 1965, no, we're not, okay, again, we're talking about 2020.
Yeah.
In 2020, can you tell me where systemic racism is going on? Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like you want to create a problem just so you can say you're fighting it.
Yep.
And, you know, things have got to get better. They've just got to get better. This whole victim mindset, this whole feeling sorry for yourself, this whole, you know, you're dragging the corpse of racism around so you can say it exists. It's got to stop. It's got to get better. And people have to take more accountability for themselves.
Amen. Zeke, it's been amazing having you on the show, brother.
Thank you
really,
so much.
Really enjoyed listening to your perspective, man. Where can people find out more about you online?
Well, right now, my main account is Twitter, Zeke Arkham. You know, I am branching out into podcasts. You know, I am branching out to see what else I can do to get my voice and perspective out there. And that's it. I'll announce everything on Twitter and I branch out from there.
Awesome. Zeke, appreciate it, bro. Thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.